Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we've got our March wrap-up. We're going to do that in just a bit. But before we do that, we have a special guest, Mr. Chris C., coming on the podcast. He's going to talk to us a little bit about our sponsor for the month of March. If you've been listening, you've heard us talk about the Praxis Conference, which is May 15th and 16th down in Houston, Texas at the Ecclesia Church, where Chris is the pastor. There's going to be a bunch of friends of the show, people like Brian Zahn, Ian Cron, Science Mike, Sarah Bessie, Aaron Nequist, and more. And Chris C is going to come on, he's going to come on the podcast, talk a little bit about that. If you haven't registered yet, I'd encourage you to go to praxisconference.com, enter the code praxis_Norrisworthy. We're going to give you a discount by doing that, 25% off. So if you haven't registered, go to praxisconference.com. You'll be able to take care of all that right there. And so I think you're going to really enjoy. Chris is going to talk to us for a little bit about the conference, and then we're going to jump right in to our March wrap-up. So without further ado, here's Chris C. All right, joining us right now is pastor of the Ecclesia Church and the host of the Praxis Conference, Chris A. Is it C or C?
It is C.
I really should have researched that, but Chris C. Yes. How long have you been down in Houston?
We started Ecclesia almost 16 years ago.
How many? 16?
Yeah.
Wow. Good work, man. I planted a church in north of Dallas, in a town called Denton, and it's about 6 years old. And actually, we've got a girl who just started law school this fall down in Houston, and she started going to your church not too long ago. She says she loves it.
Awesome.
She was actually back at our church on the Sunday that former President Bush was at your church. And I think she was heartbroken about that.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise to all of us. He had sent a message while I was in the Holy Land saying that he and Barbara wanted to come to church. And I said, great, the church will love to see you. I'm not there. And so, to my surprise, they decided to wait a week.
Really?
I was back. So
the president waited a week to go to church when you're preaching. How mind-blowing is that? I don't care what your politics are. A former president of the United States waited a week to hear you preach.
Yeah. It was a little crazy. The only time it was really unnerving was at one point I was telling a funny story or something, and you actually hear him laugh, and you know it's him, and you go, oh, that's the president laughing. It was the only time that I could. But, you know, we don't acknowledge anybody, political, anything. So, and we just wanted them to be able to worship and just be normal people. So they were great. They were fabulous.
Well, what made them decide that they wanted to come to Ecclesia?
They've got a couple of family members, their son and their grandson, that are part of the church. And so they just kind of kept hearing stories about the church and what we're up to. And I think they were deeply, profoundly intrigued. In fact, they're Episcopalian. So when their grandson first started coming to the church, he was telling them he hadn't been involved in a church really ever. So they were excited and yet suspicious. And so, you know, even Barbara Bush uses Google. So she went on and tried to find out everything about the church, about me, and she wasn't sure what to think. And then she had their rector come out and had him over for breakfast the next morning so that he could give her the scoop. And he, you know, he had just been at something I had spoken at just a week before, and he loves us and raved about us. And so she gave a speech at a graduation the next day, and she encouraged everybody to get involved in the church. She said, it could be any church. You know, we're Episcopalians. George W. is Methodist. We have Baptists in the family. We have Ecclesians in the family. We were promoted to a full-on denomination by Barbara Bush at that point.
Wow. And she name-dropped you guys as a denomination. That is pretty awesome.
Yeah. It was sweet. So you know, anytime your family is being ministered to, you know, people care about who you are. So
yeah,
there is normal a family, despite all of the fame and the power, as normal a family as you find. So.
Yeah. Well, I've got one of my mentors is in the oil business, and at one point he was actually George W.'s boss, and he advised him before he ran for governor to not run for governor because that would be a terrible idea, which obviously he did run for governor, and then obviously he became the president. And he just talks about George, you know, George, like, he's just a wonderful guy who's was in the oil business with him. And that's definitely pretty crazy to think about, though. So
I think the coolest part for us was there's a photo of them at church that one of our guys, who's a photographer, was already there taking photos. And you behind the president, there are 10 men that come regularly on a day pass from the county jail. There's a sister in the far corner that that had just been working as a prostitute 3 months before. There's a sister who had been homeless and doing wonderful sitting right next to them. And there's the CEO of an oil company. So you just look at it, all sitting with a president, and you just go, and where else but the church does that happen? And everybody's equal and the same. So it was cool.
That's some real Kingdom of Heaven stuff right there. That's outstanding.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we know if the president is going to be coming to the Praxis conference? Do we have a yes or no on that yet?
I will definitely send an invite right now. I'm going to invite him. And, don't come because you want to meet the president, but there's no telling who's going to show up. This is the thing last year. I do enough events. I've hosted the Cavils conference for five, six years in a row. I do a lot of conferences and, you know, very little impresses me. I'll be honest. You know, there's just, I got to practice and it was like family I'd never met, you know, all these people leaning into the great tradition, from totally different backgrounds and denominations, different kind of unique flares and theological bents, but all of us really being drawn to mystery and beauty and to historic practice and believing that when we connected with each other and with the historical church, that God was up to something unique. And there was a kinship unlike anything I'd ever been at. And so that's why we offered to host it next year, because Tulsa's Tulsa, and it's in Oklahoma. And it was great. I would go to Tulsa again for it, but we thought if we were in a city where everybody could fly to easily and where Ecclesi is located, it's just such a unique space. And we run a restaurant and coffee shop. It's just the kind of place that we can really open up to the city and to the world. And so I can't wait to meet the new people that'll be there and connect with people that I just instantly fell in love with as dear beloved friends last year.
Yeah. How did you get connected to the Praxis Conference? Was last year your first time?
Yeah, it was. David Gunger is a good friend, and David told me that I needed to participate, and so I said I would. And anybody that's people are really confused at times when they come to Ecclesi. They don't know where do we fit. You know, we're not a denomination where there's enough. There's so much liturgical expression. We're so focused on the Eucharist. And yet, you know, we're a super welcoming church and that everybody's welcome. You know, we're really these Bible people. The Bible's really central in worship for us. People come in and they don't know, like, what are you? Or they come in and they go, oh, you're charismatic like me, or you're Anglican like me. Or they just assume, like, because there's some of the, you're Catholic like me, not Roman Catholic, but so many Catholics that end up at our church. So for me, this becomes a place where it makes some sense who we are. You get other people around you that are in the same place. And it was really good for my soul. And there's just so many people to learn from. And people writing, Ecclesia is, we're gifted at writing our own unique and beautiful liturgy. But I don't talk to churches every day that are doing that, you know, that are having men and women in their church write their liturgy and really are involved in prayers are, you know, creative and beautiful. And so if I can sit down over lunch with people that are actually doing that, which doesn't happen for me at conferences, man, I'm thrilled. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Now, I got an email from someone asking if the Praxis Conference wasn't just for people who are clergy, but for normal people, because she heard words like the great tradition and liturgy and ecumenical. And she was like, I don't really know all those words, but can I still come to this even if I'm not clergy?
Yeah, that's great. If you resonate deeply with the body of Christ is broken for you and the blood of Christ is shed for you, I think it's a great event for you. It's going to be worshipful. It's going to be inspiring. All those things. So if we get only clergy, it might be a little boring. Although this is a fun group of clergy, and we're going to enjoy some really good food and some really good wine. I think we're going to have a little wine event to raise money for some water wells. I'm not sure when we're doing that, but I think in the evening, maybe that's Friday evening. So we're going to have a blast together.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So there's a bunch of people that listeners of the show we're going to recognize, obviously. Ian Kronzman a couple times, Science Mike, Brian Zahn's been on the podcast a few times, Sarah Bessie. Plenty of others are going to be there. You're obviously going to be presenting as well?
I will be.
Outstanding. Is there someone who's going to be coming for the first time you've never met before that you're really excited to get to know?
I think there's a lot of people I'm really excited to connect with. Glenn Packiam was the big surprise for me last year. He is just a brilliant, brilliant young leader. I would have assumed, I would have made some presumptions about any church connected to New Life in Colorado, what kind of church it would be, what it'd be like. Mm-hmm. So if you told me there was this deeply liturgical church that was a part of New Life in Colorado, led by a brilliant young Indian man, I would have said, that sounds insane. That can't be true. And it's better than fiction, the people that you get to meet. So Glenn was just a brilliant teacher. I get really encouraged when I'm seeing some younger leaders that are just bright and smart and thinking out of the box and bringing people together from different traditions. So Glenn's one of the people on my list I'm excited to hear from again.
Oh, that's good. Well, Chris, thanks for your time. We're looking forward to seeing you down there. It's May 15th and 16th, and I hope all my listeners join me down there. Thanks, man.
Awesome. We're looking forward to it, buddy.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today it's time for the March.
Get ready for some awesome.
You know who that is, guys. At this point, you've realized it's Jonathan R. Stormont back on the podcast.
Good to be back with you, Luke.
Yeah. How's life?
I'm sorry for saying something when I told everyone to get ready for awesome.
I was saying we're doing the March wrap-up show. We've got a lot of guests to discuss. Josh Patrick, Mr. Orberg, Brian Zahn, Dr. Peter Inns, Dr. John Orberg, if you want to put the doctors in all those, Dr. Tony Jones, Father Richard Rohr. We've got a lot of good stuff to discuss. So none other than Jonathan Stormont to be the one to do this with us. So
yeah.
Thanks for coming back on the show.
Dude, I loved your last month. I'm glad to get to be back to talk to you about it and give you a hard time.
What?
I feel like every time you have Richard Rohr on the show, you need to ask me on as kind of a counterpoint.
I don't even know what you mean by that.
Oh, I think anyone listening will know what I mean by that. If they listen to the Rohr part, and if they haven't, I don't know why you're listening to this one instead of the.
Yeah,
it's probably my mom.
If they are listening to this podcast and they're upset because they've only heard half of the Rohr podcast, it was actually your idea to split into two parts. So. All angry emails go to Jonathan Stormont at stormy.close.com or whatever your name is. I don't know. But, yeah.
Yes, as your executive producer, I and also all sponsorship money goes to that same address. I think one thing we got to get out on the table right now is how you've sold out.
What? I have not sold out?
No, that's true. What's the next sponsor going to be?
It's noneofyourbusiness.com.
That's you are just creatively on fire today.
Hey, let me
Stormy
just say,
at stormy.com, noneofyourbusiness.com.
Hey, leave me alone. I'm in the website world today.
Yeah.
You know, it's they're helping pay for some microphones and interfaces, and this thing doesn't pay for itself until now. Sponsorship's trying to help with that. There's nothing wrong.
No, that's true.
Sponsors.
I'm looking at the golden microphone you have in front of you and the Mr. T starter kit that you've mm-hmm. got hanging around your neck.
Yep.
It's really impressive what you've been able to do with this quote unquote Christian podcast.
First of all, I don't know how many people call it actually Christian, but thank you for saying that. And I appreciate your nice, kind words that you're giving to me in the podcast, because I'm so sick of people giving me compliments about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was talking to someone who lives like 10 minutes away from me in a church I'm a part of. And they were saying, this person is not a part of our church. And they said, you know, I just love Jonathan Stormont. I mean, if I lived maybe 30 minutes closer to Abilene, I would drive there every Sunday. Which made me think, you don't come to my church, but you would drive 2.5 hours to hear Jonathan Stormont. So that actually gives me a definitive difference. He is actually worth 2 hours and 40 minutes of driving more than listening to me preach.
No, that sounds about right. That's nice. That's just the cost of orthodoxy. I mean, two hours for Orthodox people. Dude, you were talking to my parents. That's
true.
Fine.
Yeah.
That's where your problem is.
Yeah,
dude, okay, so you had a huge month as far as different people that you got to talk to.
A wide variety of conversations.
And the first one is I was so glad that you had our mutual friend Josh Patrick on. Josh, if you didn't hear that podcast, is facing a serious bout with cancer. He's our age. He's a preacher. He's been in the same preacher group that we've been in for the last few years. Wife, kids.
Yeah, three of them. Yeah. Stage 4 colon cancer. And what were you thinking when you first, I guess, did you get an email from Rick? Is that how you heard about it, or
yeah, or no? I think Josh Ross.
Something like that. But when you first heard that, I mean, what was your response?
You know, just a sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach, because I immediately started thinking about his little girls and the challenge that is ahead of them, and you know, frankly, just what a hard season this is going to be. I loved hearing you talk to him and him kind of airing it out. Yeah. He's been very open about this season. He wrote for me on Scott McKnight's blog about it. And then,
yeah, that's actually why I asked him to be on the podcast, is after that blog that you had him write.
Did you know, like, one of the things he said that I was wondering what you thought was, you know, he said, one of the things he said, and I've heard several people who have gone through like really difficult times, faced their own mortality, say something like they see this as the Lord's discipline.
Yeah.
How'd that strike you?
You know, I guess there's like two ways to think about that. Like, as a kid, you get in trouble at school, you go to the principal's office because you're being disciplined. You're getting in trouble. You go to jail because you're being disciplined. You did something wrong. But say someone goes off and decides they want to be part of a sports team. Well, they have to, you know, get up early in the morning. They've got to go train. They're being disciplined. If you go to the military and you're going to go to boot camp, you're being disciplined in that. Now, there's no, you know, value judgment over like your lifestyle or the choices you made. You're just being improved by that. And so if you want to go disciplined as though like you're being punished, which I think that's, I don't know about you, but that makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But if it's God's somehow working through this circumstance, and it's a very dark circumstance, but God's going to somehow use this to shape and mold you, I completely get behind that. What about you?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good way of saying it. I'm right now taking this, I'm auditing this class with Jeff Childers on classic Christian spiritual texts like Teresa of Avila and Julian of Norwich and people like that. And they talk like this, and it's very much the second way, I think.
Where they talk as though it's being punished, or this is just God using it?
Discipline. Well, I mean, it's kind of like discipline in the sense of what you said with military boot camp.
Yeah.
Like, how else are we going to become the kinds of people who can stand before God and not like a discipline, like a, you know, like a working out of the soul?
Mm-hmm. Do you think in antiquity, people were far more comfortable to say anytime a bad circumstance happened to them that the gods were punishing them? Doesn't it seem like a language that was used quite often, just not even in the Christian community, but just outside, as you know, like a pagan world? Anything, something bad, well, you know, obviously the gods are upset at us.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, that, I do think that is the case. I think the difference here is that it's not like a like you were saying, punishing. I don't think it's punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I think God is at work in it. And honestly, there are people. I'm co-preaching with Nika Maples this weekend. And
what was her book that she wrote? Like 12 page?
Right. Yeah, you should have her on here. She's amazing. That's me speaking as the executive producer, self-appointed executive producer.
Yeah.
And just reading through kind of the stuff that she's going to say, she uses that kind of language. Like, looking back on it, there's stuff that she wouldn't have wished on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't trade it now for the world. She became a more genuinely joyful, humble, hopeful person through the very stuff that she, and I think that's kind of a Christian take on suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
know if Patrick talked about this, and I think he might have, but I've heard a lot of people talk about they're less certain of a whole lot of things than they used to be. And I think Patrick talks about, you know, I'm very confident of some things. I don't have answers for everything. And I think that's kind of a disposition that when I've gone through tough times, which they're by no means like Josh's or Nika. Is that, yeah. Nothing like those situations, but they've been tough for me, and I've looked back on them and I've gone, I'm glad that I've gone through them, but I would never want to do that again.
Right.
And in those moments, I feel like the healthiest way for me to make sense of my world is to say, well, this is something that God is using to shape me. And that's the whole Viktor Frankl stuff that, you know, the psychologist who went through the Holocaust, and he talked about, you know, a person can survive anything if they have a meaning or a purpose to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so beneficial about the language of God's disciplining me. Because it's not as though, like, you're off on an island all by yourself and God is absent, but somehow God steps into our darkness and our struggles and he's using it for something better.
Yeah. I think that's right. And reading those kind of Catholic mystics, Christian mystics has got me. Do you remember the first kind of preacher camp we ever did when Randy Harris gave us that prayer, that like John Wesley prayer? God,
oh, help your life to be terrible, but not too terrible, and help you to not succeed, but not fail so much that you want to shoot yourself. It was something like that.
Yeah, I think that's more how you read it than what it was. I felt the same way. I think the prayer was something like, I give you everything to do with as you will.
Yeah.
My family, my job, my health, my friends, I submit to you. I'm probably not to a place where I should even say this yet, but I have never been able to pray that prayer until the last couple of months.
Really?
Yeah, because it's terrifying.
What's happened in the last couple of months? Obviously, you've been
Here's what the Christian mystics know that I don't think we know, that people like maybe Anika and Josh do. God is really, really good. He's even better than those things.
Do you think you have to go through suffering to get to that realization?
I would hope not, but
it seems like most people say you have to suffer to grow. And that seems like that's some next level stuff to be able to say God is good. Even if I have stage 4 cancer and I've got 3 little daughters that who knows what's going to happen to, you know, them as, and hopefully he recovers completely. But I mean, that's just a traumatic thing to be able to still say, you know, God is good. And that's what I loved about his story is he's the kind of role model that I really admire. And it's not, I don't need the role models that are, hey, I'm cool and I can validate your faith because I believe the same thing you do, which I needed that as a 12-year-old. Like I needed a Tim Tebow to say, it's okay to be, to say a prayer and to believe in Jesus and to not do X, Y, and Z. For me now, I need the role models who've gone through difficult things and who in some ways legitimize my faith because it's not been easy for them. They haven't got what they want. They haven't had life go the way that it was drawn up in kindergarten for them as they would have written it down, but they continue to have faith. That's what I need from him. And that's what he gives us.
You know, just an important side note here. I've noticed that where this gets really ugly is when you say that to other people when they are hurting.
What do you mean?
like, this is something only Josh Patrick can say. And if like I try saying it to Josh Patrick, I become a friend of Job.
Oh yeah. I mean, yes, that makes perfect sense. I mean, Josh can say this cause he's going through it, but and I don't know if you noticed this, but when I was talking to him, I mean, I didn't want to do any joking. I didn't want to, I mean, this was just a very much, this is you talking. I don't really know if I should, and I didn't really kind of push back on anything he said, like I would in a normal discussion. Like I could push back on, you know, Peter Enns' Christology or something like that. But when it's Josh Patrick dealing with how he's processing a very terrible diagnosis,
it's holy ground.
Yeah, it's definitely holy ground. It's sacred space. And I had the honor to walk into that and to hear him talk about it. And hopefully everyone else felt that same way when they got to hear him talk about it.
I did. I mean, he's a great, great dude. May he live to a ripe old age.
Yeah. Amen. Well, one of the things I think you see in what he was saying is that it's about formation, even in adversity, which is a nice segue into John Ortberg's book.
Yeah.
Because that seemed to be him channeling his guru, his Randy Harris, which would be Dallas Willard. If you guys don't know, Randy Harris is like, you know what? Randy Harris reminded me of Richard Rohr. I texted him right after I got done talking to Rohr, and I was like, he reminds me of you. Because he's kind of like that guru who's been in our lives for a long time. And many of you know John Ortberg was mentored by Dallas Willard for a long time, and a lot of Willard's stuff kind of worked his way into John Ortberg's stuff.
Yeah. His big thing that I think has blessed people through the big idea in the book, maybe it was the one before this though, the soul keeping book.
Yeah, because that was his you know, kind of book in honor of Willard and what the work that Willard's had in his life or influences out of his life.
But he mentioned it again in all the places. Yeah. All places to go is that the greatest gift you give God is not what you do with your life, but who you're becoming. Mm-hmm. And that every time I hear that, it's kind of like oxygen to my soul.
Really? Why is it like oxygen to your soul?
Because I think I'm a failure a lot. The kind of stuff that I hoped I would do, or, you know, I see things that are not good in my own life, lack of virtue in certain places, and the way I fail at like competency in my job from time to time, just stuff like that. And I know we're going to get to the Enneagram later. I'm a 3 on the Enneagram too, and part of the, it's performance is what Enneagram number 3 is tempted to.
Yeah.
And I often feel like I fail at performing. Hmm. And this kind of challenges that, because it says that's the greatest gift that you give God, and hopefully the world on behalf of God, is not any performance. It is who you're becoming underneath that.
Do you feel better about the kind of person you're becoming, or the performance that you're giving?
Yeah.
Sometimes for me, it's like, it would be easier if it was just the performance, because if someone, we're talking about the Enneagram, if you haven't done any research on or work on it, the 3 type in a lot of ways is the actor person whose struggle is to be honest. And so they've grown to be a person who can act and play the part really well, which, as you can tell, a lot of, you know, preachers, politicians kind of fit that role. But if you've learned to kind of do that, it's easier to put on a good performance than to actually do the hard work of looking at who you actually are inside. In some ways, right. That's harder for me. And I know you were saying that's comforting to you, but for me, sometimes it's hard, because, you know, being a husband, being a father who's always patient and always kind and always thoughtful of the other person is far more challenging to me than to perform well in, you know, different mediums.
So here, what you just said is right, and I know we're not Rohr yet, but basically I think the true measure of who you are is found, like Rohr was saying to you, in how Lindsay, your wife, who she says you are, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, what the reviews on your podcast or, you know, whatever. But there's a, that's the temptation, the real great temptation. And, you know, we're both pastors. We've seen this time and time again. We've been at deathbeds or we've done funerals where the obituary doesn't line up with what the person was trying to do with their life.
As in it oversells them?
Not that it oversells them. It's that, you know, for example, I don't know that your obituary is going to mention you had a really great podcast.
Well, maybe you just make sure that happens. Okay, that's your one job. Make sure that's in. No, I hope my obituary talks about that I have three wonderful daughters that know they're loved and they know they're cared for, and a wife who knows that she's the most important thing in the world. I hope that's what it says. But that's a whole lot harder than having a good podcast.
Right. And I think that's what Ortberg does well, and what Dallas Willard did before him, mm-hmm. was just say, you know, there's a reason that we're actually trying to, that we're workaholics, that we, you know, tend to try to put our identity on our job, or whatever it is. And you know, you've seen people who have years of regret piled up because they chased after something that was good that they just put in a kind of an idolatrous place.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that Keller stuff about sin, is that you take a good thing and make it a great thing, or you just elevate the importance of something that it doesn't really merit. And that's, if you go back to the numb stuff, I mean, that's what work is. I mean, it can be just another, you know, a buzz that you chase after. I mean, you've got a blog that's done really well and you've put some books out, and it'd be easy just to say, well, I'm going to use those things as metrics to determine how good I am. And so you'd never have to do the hard work of looking at who you are at home.
That's right. And who you are before God. I think family can be an idol as well. And that's when you run out onto the soccer field yelling at the coach. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm serious. Like, I feel a great temptation to put the weight of worship on my very great, wonderful, sweet kids who I love very much. And I'm trying to love them enough not to put them in the place of God.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I definitely can see how you do that. I would love to see you run on a soccer field, to be honest. I mean, I just love to see that. But okay. Yeah. So Ortberg, I love what he was talking about in his filter for how you determine the will of God, that it's not as though God is saying, okay, you've got three options and there's only one that God really wants to do. You know, God said, I can use you in all these different circumstances, assuming the options are not like, you know, help the lady across the street or join ISIS. Okay, those are not obviously real ones that people are really going to wrestle with, but three good opportunities in front of you. I don't think God's saying, this is only the only one that I'm going to work through. But instead, I think his filter that I think he puts out there is really what's best for other people, and use that as a filter to help you determine what God's will is for your life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that book is a great book to give, like college students. Cause,
oh yeah, definitely.
In a college town, what's God's will for my life? And he has a line in there where he says, a lot of times we're asking that cause we want God to take the burden of the decision off of us.
Yeah.
And I do think this is one of the things God does. God gives us like the ability to kind of have a little kingdom of our own, to dominion. We have dominion to be able to make a life and to kind of orient it around his purposes or not. And
okay. So let me ask you a personal question, which you can pass on if you want. I mean, I'll answer it for you if you do pass on it, but you have the opportunity. So when did you go to Highland?
2010.
So it's 2009. You're wrestling with the decision. You know, you have a great job at a church that both of us love and care about a whole lot. You could stay there. You could go to Highland. Now, it'd be easy for us to use kind of the non-Ortberg language and say, well, one of these is God's will and one of them isn't. But as you're making that decision, are you thinking, you know, one of these is the right one and this is the one that only God can use? Or are you saying both of these are good options?
Right.
It's just determining which one am I going to be most, you know, fill in the blank at.
That's probably the hardest decision that I've ever had to deal with. And, you know, Ortberg in his book has this moment where he says, we talk about feeling peace. Like, I'm just not at peace with it. And he's like, well, that's not the story of God.
There's no peace. Yeah, there's a lot of places that there's no peace.
What normally happens is God calls, people feel abject terror, and then they try to, like, avoid it somehow, wrestle with it for a long time, and then...
That reminds me of Leslie telling me about when she first said yes to go on a date with you. It's a whole lot like that.
Oh, yeah. That's probably true. So to answer your question, we were so, like, torn, and it was one of the harder things I've ever done, and I have never heard God's voice clearer in my life than 6 months after we got to Highland.
Really?
Yeah. Saying, this is what I want you to do.
It would have been great if you would have got that before. And like, God, come on, let's work on the timing here.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't say, you know, I hear God, I don't want to take God's name in vain and say, you know, if Highland like terminates me tomorrow, you know, like.
Actually, since you're on the podcast, David,
you're
Ray,
the executive producer of Highland. So.
I really am. No, that would, they don't want me to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like that might be how God works. Look, the doors, there's two open doors. They're great opportunities. And he let Leslie and I wrestle and deal with kind of the emotional anguish of saying goodbye to people we love, a place we love.
And by people you love, you're referring to me, of course.
No, there's people, so that'd be more than one, love, so...
No, I understand that. Okay, but when you go to prayer, you don't always get the answer you want. You don't get the clear voice from God every time you're making a decision. It's often you've got to wrestle with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to our friend Brian Zahn, who did a lot of good work on prayer. Have you read some of his stuff before?
Yeah, I think I've read three of his books. I love Brian Zahn. I would love to go to his kind of prayer with liturgy thing and hear how he does it.
Beck and I have talked about going to that, which I think would be real fascinating to hear Beck talk about prayer with Zahn. I think that'd be a fun conversation.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding. I actually liked one of my favorite parts of this month was the 10 minutes leading up to you guys getting down to business talking about prayer when y'all were talking about N.T. Wright.
And it was more like 20 minutes, I think.
Well, what I like about, I have found that I love charismatic people who like N.T. Wright. Nobody's coming to mind other than Brian Zahn right now.
No?
Oh, the listeners at home, Luke is pointing at himself.
No, charismatic.
That's
as
a default position, by the way. He is always doing that.
As charismatic, you're referring to more Pentecostal leaning, not as though not people who just are magnetic with their personality. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yes, I am.
But there is obviously a growing number of those people who fit in that category. What is it about that category, that those group of people, those people that you
like
so much?
Two-thirds of the Christian world, first off, really,
are charismatic.
And I think it's good for Western people to hear that. You know, in Abilene, our church is in a kind of poor socioeconomic part of town, and a lot of people who are coming to Highland and joining, and they're helping save us because they're charismatic. To them, the world is enchanted. Every breath is a gift of God. Anything's possible. They help snap us out of kind of deism.
Hmm. When you say enchanted, I know you're homeschooled, so I'm not sure if you're like really referring to believing that they're like deer that talk. What do you mean exactly by enchanted?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a podcast in itself.
We're doing a podcast right now. That's.
I would point you to The Weight of Glory, the sermon that C.S. Lewis did when he was opening up his professorship at Magdala College, where he basically said to people who he has this line where he says, "Do you think I'm weaving a spell? Well, remember, spells can be used for a couple of different reasons, and one of them is to undo spells that are already cast. And for the last 100 years, our society has been under a growing myth that is becoming more and more accepted as a fact, that this enlightenment is all there is to the world, that we now know everything, that the universe fits in a test tube, and we have written off thousands of years of the human experience as far-fetched.
Yeah. So is this kind of like what Rohr was talking about with, you know, part of faith is knowing and unknowing together?
There is a mystery to it. There's also a bit in which I think so much of particularly wealthy white European descent people and we kind of bought into this wholeheartedly, the Enlightenment, which has got a lot of great things. It's super rationalistic. Mm-hmm. And it, like, for example, bring up myth to somebody and it's interesting to see myth is not the opposite of fact. The opposite of myth is not the opposite of truth. The opposite of truth is fiction. Mm-hmm. Myth is a way of telling things in a way that kind of go around telling things that are true through your imagination.
Yeah.
Science is the way of looking at the world without metaphor, just mm-hmm. naked. And that can only do so much. I think it's actually incredibly limited and unaware often of how limited a world without metaphor is.
And so you think the charismatics who like Tom Wright are the people who are tapping into that we can learn from?
Yeah, I do. Yesterday I had lunch with Daryl Tippins, who is a great guy, a great scholar, goes to church with us. And he was talking about a church, an Assembly of God church. I don't know, I can't remember the details, but a few years ago they came to the conclusion that they wanted to become Anglican, like you do.
Just
the natural next step. So they get like an Anglican bishop to come ordain the whole congregation, and there are a couple thousand of them. And the bishop, after he's with them and seeing kind of this vibrant worship, says, you know, one of the things that I think is happening here is you guys have the fire and we have the hearth. You know,
what does the hearth mean?
Like the structure and the institutions that have kind of kept this thing going for a couple thousand years. But often, if those two things aren't together, it can be really bad. You know, fire outside of a fireplace can do a lot of damage, and a hearth without a fire is pretty much useless.
Yeah. So what do you think that would look like for a church that leans to be more on the hearth side than the fire side to bring that in? Do they just need to read Jim Cimbala? And what do you think that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, Jim Cimbala is not a bad place to start. The guy loves prayer, and here's my take, and this is kind of going to show my bent. I think part of the reason that churches have become all hearth and no fire is because we're so homogenous. Like, I think a lot of times we try to replace, like a lot of churches that are primarily white, try to replace soul with a drum kit or, we have a drum kit. I'm not against that. I'm actually for it. But what I was telling yesterday, we had a great example of this in communion. One of our guys at our church who I just love, always comes to church wearing sweatpants, and we're better for it. And he was passing out communion to somebody, and I don't know who it was. So if you're listening to this, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to out you. But I just heard this story secondhand. The person asked this guy wearing sweatpants, "Is this gluten-free?" when the communion got to him. And the guy, my friend, said, you know, he's not like a brought up in church guy. He's a neighbor who is a Christian, a newer Christian. And he responds to this woman by saying, oh, yeah, totally, totally. They're not going to charge you for this. I love that because I think that's kind of an example of what happens when a church gets together, all these different kinds of people. And, you know,
there's something beautiful about that.
Where
you're bringing people who are different together, and that's part of what the body of Christ is supposed to be.
And yeah, and so we have people, you know, who stand at times where we wouldn't normally stand if we were just white middle class people, are all Christians for decades. We have people who don't obey like the kind of subtle church rules that me and you grew up knowing.
Yeah.
And we're better for it.
Yeah.
And so there's some soul in that.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, let me change gears on the Brian Zahn conversation. So Brian Zahn starts the conversation off and says he started doing this prayer, what does he call it? Prayer lab, prayer something. Prayer school.
Prayer school, yeah.
Because his elders or leaders noticed that he was getting good at prayer. He said, I'm praying well and I can do this. I want to show you guys how to do this. So at first he realizes he can do prayer school because he feels like he's getting good at prayer. Well, at the end of the conversation, I say, well, he says something about you can't judge prayer. And I had a listener tweet this to me or say something on Facebook or somewhere about this and said, Luke, you let him have this inconsistency where at the beginning he says he's good at prayer and at the end he says you can't judge prayer.
Mm.
And I get that. I mean, obviously the language he used was clearly contradictory. But I think what he was trying to say is you can't judge every time you get down on your knees and pray or whatever posture you use to pray and evaluate that as though it was a win or a loss. Like, right. Okay, well, that was a gold medal prayer. That was a bronze. And I think the metaphor he used was like going to the gym. Like you go to work out this morning. You did your, what were you saying? You did the buns of steel stuff? Right, whatever workout
it's
video.
Jazzercise.
Jazzercise.
And I told you that in confidence.
Okay, well, I have confidence that you did that. So you do that, and you don't like, okay, take your shirt off and flex in the mirror and say, oh, I look so much better now. But if you do that over 6 months time, you're going to be healthier, your energy is going to be better, your flexibility is going to be better. All these things that you can't judge after one setting is going to be showing, but
right.
Just one time. Do you think you can judge your prayer life?
Oh, I think he was wrong. You don't want to make prayer some kind of competition. I think what his point was that people could tell he was becoming a different kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to say it's because I'm praying well.
Do you think have you had that experience with prayer? Like you've grown into prayer and you feel like it's made a difference and that someone can look at you and go, oh yeah, he's praying more. And it shows off in different areas of your life.
I hope so. One of the things that Teresa of Avila says is if people claim to talk for God, one of the things it should show is that they're not anxious or they're becoming less anxious because that's one of the things that happens. It's not like a value judgment as it is a kind of fruit that you bear in the presence of God.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, let's talk about Pete Enns. Love Pete Enns. Third time he's on the podcast.
Dude, I love how much he makes fun of you.
Okay, well, that's one thing that I don't think is really nice about Pete. But
it's
besides,
my favorite part of having Peter Enns on is that you've got this like world-class scholar.
And then just, Pete, too.
Yeah. Who?
Oh,
well played.
Thank
well
you.
Played. Who just eviscerates you on
what?
So many different things.
I don't think he eviscerated me.
Yeah, you know, I think whenever you want to be kind of humbled, which hopefully is often, that you could go back and listen to that because he's quick, he's funny.
Yeah. He's a scholar who is a funny guy and he's engaging. I think that's why his work's so good. I mean, he's got good stuff to say, but also he's able to package it in a way that people can get to it. So I love his stuff. I gave his most recent book, or I suggested it to a friend of mine, and she'd grown up in church, and went off to a Christian college, and she had never read anything like that. And she said something to the extent of, I wish I would have known this stuff when I was a kid. And I thought, yeah, of course. And the next day, Ends puts out a great blog about parenting with kind of a more healthy understanding of Scripture and the benefits of that. So we played right into what the conversation I had with this girl was about. But I found it really fascinating because what she said is that at church, she learned, she learned a few key verses that like you go to if you're scared or you're sad or you're comfortable. And as she was saying that, I saw one of my friends, a youth minister named Josh Jones, had this NCAA bracket knockoff thing with not basketball teams, but favorite Bible verses. And he posts on there and he has like the four different quadrants and like three of them are from Paul. Or the majority of them are from Paul. And you go, okay, we've picked and chosen a few things that Paul said to be the best thing about the Bible. Jesus, yeah, he doesn't make as much on the list, but clearly Paul gives us these good Bible verses that feel nice. But the problem with like having these favorite Bible verses is that you never really get the content of the Bible. You just get these passages that sound great to you.
Jim Woodruff, an old Church of Christ preacher who I love, he would always say, you can't get the gospel if you start in the epistles. You got to start with the gospel and then it's everywhere. He was pushing back against what you're saying too. And I do. I find the gospel all in Paul's letters. But
say that again?
I find the gospel all in Paul's letters.
Really?
Once I read the gospels. I mean, because think about what Paul's trying to do. I mean, Scott McKnight's new book, Paul, Fellowship of Difference. If listeners haven't read that, it is an amazing book. It is really convicting. And basically, he's saying that what Paul's trying to do in every context is what Jesus did in the Gospels with creating a community of difference to show the world that Jesus is the Son of God and King of the universe.
But how does starting with Jesus help you see that in Paul?
Well, you have to understand what Paul's trying to do. Paul's planting these churches saying Jesus is Lord in a place where nobody believed that. He's saying the most audacious things about that Jesus is raised from the dead, and he basically does. Think about all those parties in the Gospels that Jesus, the meals that Jesus throws. I mean, 1 Corinthians is basically table etiquette. He's trying to get people to, it's basically what a Jesus kind of fellowship looks like in Corinth.
Yeah. So he's trying to do that, the Jesus stuff, in different contexts, but you understand what he's doing, it starts with the understanding of Jesus.
Right. Yeah, he's not doing theory. He's a practical guy working out practical problems of...
Yeah. And so it ends where it is like Christocentric. Like that's the kind of reading he's pushing for, which it seems like what he's saying is that you read everything through Jesus, but if you read stuff from like Keller, I don't know his work super well, but it seems like he's saying something else about that same idea.
Yeah, I think Keller is Christocentric as well, and I think that's actually where people like Peter Enns and Tim Keller would overlap, because at the end of the day, they're going to say the Bible through and through is about Jesus. That's what it means to kind of read it Christianly.
But wouldn't the difference be there, and I don't know if Keller's in this camp, but there's some people who say, you know, if you read the Old Testament, you can, well, there's a rock there, and Jesus is the rock, and so obviously that's Jesus right there. And so you have this...
Paul says that, right?
I know, but he... Okay, bring Paul into it. But Enns would say that's Midrash. Like, Paul is saying, I'm going to reinterpret this, but he's doing it in a first century rabbinic way, which we all understand is him playing fast and loose with the text in a way that communicates the truth of it. But if he was on a history class, would he say that that was actually Jesus of Nazareth within the rock? I don't know.
Yeah. Right. And that gets back to my point about enlightenment, framing the discussion and kind of reading the Bible with a greater imagination, like than just this flat reading. I mean, I think Paul read it after he has an experience of the risen King Jesus. Paul reads it and he's like, no, the rock, the water that flows out of the rock, even in the Exodus, is that's what God did in Jesus. And
And so you think if you're not bound to an Enlightenment reading, you can really get the heart of what Paul is saying.
Well, I don't know. Who am I to know that?
You've been on a podcast like 14 times. That is a huge credential that you need to be thankful for.
That's true. That's true. I'm putting that on like my business cards and resume and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, how I'm aware that I am a product of the spirit of my age. And so I'd like to have a little bit of humility when it comes to reading the Bible and just say, I could be wrong on this, but what I like is I think throughout the centuries, a Christian reading of the Bible does what both Peter Enns and Tim Keller and people like that try to do, which is find Jesus everywhere or read the Bible through the lens of the character of Jesus. And that's what both of those guys tend to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things you said is very important, and it also fits with what Enns encourages people to have. And that's not this flat reading of scripture in which everything is of equal importance. You can say, I can have some humility about maybe exactly what Paul means here, but I know the centerpiece is Jesus and all the other stuff. I don't have to exactly have a 100% certainty about exactly what's going on here as long as I have the centerpiece down.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way of reading it.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Tony Jones, which, by the way, we had a giveaway for an extra copy of the book that I was given, and I have some friends, some listeners down in Mozambique who are missionaries that they like the book. They filled out a thing on iTunes, and so I'm sending them the book.
Cool.
All the way down to Mozambique. Now, the last winner of a book giveaway was like in England. And so I feel like we need to do something local next time. And
you are international, man.
Something that doesn't charge like $42 to ship. That's really why I don't want to do the next one. It's going to
really
be
really what sponsorship's for.
Yeah, right? Exactly. The whole sponsorship is paying for the shipping for that. So, Tony Jones.
How'd that interview happen?
Well, let me give you the back. I've gotten some pushback on having Tony Jones on the podcast. And so let me set this up. A few months ago, I was talking with the senior publicist for Harper One. And that's the publicist that Tony Jones worked through. And she said, yeah, Tony's book's coming out in March. I said, yeah, I'd love to have him on. Just keep me posted, send me a copy of the book or whatever when it comes out, and I'll have him on. And so that was last year. Well, I know he's going to come on the podcast, and I see probably the beginning of this month, last month, sometime, this drama that's going on. If you've been on the internet and looked into Tony Jones, you might have stumbled upon this, which you have, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah. And I had no clue about it when I initially said to Harper One, yeah, I'm going to have him on. And so I was kind of in this tough situation because, first of all, there's some things on the internet that are very scathing that you just don't want anyone saying them about you. There's some rough things. And on the one hand, it's like, well, I don't want to be encouraging this sort of behavior. And some people say, let's protest and we don't want to support the book and we don't want to support him. And so I don't know Tony. I don't know his ex-wife. I don't know the people who are blogging about this. I don't know anyone. And so I called up a friend who does know Tony. And I said, hey, what's the deal? This is going on. What should I do? And he says, I know Tony. I vouch for him. And I said, okay. And I just had to make a guess on what the best thing to do is. I trust my friend. He trusts Tony. And that's the decision I made. Since then, obviously, I've gotten some pushback on, you know, why I have him on the podcast. And I don't know, because it's a tough thing to do on the internet, because it's not like people I'm talking to. Because as a pastor, you and I have been in situations like this where you have two people who are saying two different stories about what happened. And if one of them's right, it paints a whole different picture for the other person and vice versa, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the biggest ministry regrets I have is of a situation years ago in which there was someone kind of, if the quote unquote, the little guy was being oppressed by the big guy. And I'm just going to leave in ambiguity because I don't want to get into the generalities of it. But long and short end of it is I, not intentionally, but I ended up acting in a way that it seemed as though I was on the big guy's side. And afterwards, someone told me, hey, the way you acted looked like you were ignoring the little guy. And I didn't see it. I was 24 at the time, and I did not have the wisdom to put it together, and I deeply regret that. And so I don't ever want to do that again, but in this situation, there's just a lot of facts and details I just don't know. And I was just trying to make the best decision I could.
You know, I think you're kind of putting your finger on one of the great challenges that Christians have with today. One of the things is you get to do a podcast where me and people like me get to listen to people who we really want to ask these questions to, mm-hmm. that we would probably not get to meet or talk to, and we kind of vicariously get to do that through the podcast. The other problem is, you know, this is an incarnational thing, and things like forgiveness and justice and reconciliation, those don't happen unless they happen incarnationally. Did you read Richard Beck's post last week, last Friday, on the small politics of church?
I think I did.
It's great. I mean, we come in a Baptist tradition, which basically says, if you want to make the world a better place, be in a local community of faith.
Oh, yeah.
That I vote for Jesus for president every 4 years. I try to make my life my argument. And I think this is the way to go about having those kind of really hard Christian conversations. It does not happen on the internet. And so, I mean, to me, when I heard that story, I thought, if there was a marriage in my church that was going through this very tragic thing, the last thing I would do is stand up and preach a sermon that took a side.
Of course. You can't do that.
I would, if I was sitting in front of the spouse who had been injured, wronged, oppressed, whatever it is, you know, I'd probably tear up listening to her story. And if I was sitting with the spouse who had, you know, been the primary problem or whatever the accusations are, you know, I would probably have some kind of empathy for, you know, I don't want to be judged by my worst moments. And one of the challenges I think we have in trying to do church on the internet is it's disembodied.
Yeah.
And so we can rage without people. If their people become ideas, they're dehumanized. Yeah. And honestly, I don't know the details of all the story. I know that it was kind of a brouhaha, and that you kind of naively stumbled into.
Yeah, I don't like do the whole blog thing a whole lot. I read my friends' blogs, and that's about it. And so I really don't know all this stuff. But there's a difference in this and say like the Mark Driscoll stuff, because the Mark Driscoll stuff is not about his personal life. It's about what a leadership is doing.
Yeah.
And even if like, and even some of the drama with Rob Bell, it's, you know, Rob Bell's ideas. It's Rob Bell's thoughts about, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that's different than this is what happens behind closed doors in someone's house, that it's a he said, she said thing, which I'm not diminishing the veracity of one side or the other. I'm just saying it's a different context than what, okay, this is what, you know, Rob Bell said in an interview with Oprah, or this is what, you know, Mark Driscoll's done, and this is what they've said. This seems like this is a very important subject that people who really know the details need to really be in the middle of it, but I don't know. I don't pretend to know the right thing for us to do about it, and I just hope I can talk about books more in the future and not about this kind of stuff.
Well, I actually liked that podcast. I thought it was interesting, and I'm glad that you got to interview Richard Rohr after you took some flack for that, because Richard Rohr always dotes on you.
I just think he's a really wise and astute person, and I don't think it's anything more than that.
Yeah, I bet that's what you think. Mm-hmm. Couple of things. One, I couldn't help but notice that you referred to me as Little Johnny.
What are you talking about?
I think you know what I'm talking about. When
you misunderstood that. I was telling a story about someone, and I didn't want to say who it was, and so I just created the name that people wouldn't know who I was talking about.
Okay. I'm going to tell a story about a guy named Narcissistic let's see, narcissistic Luke. Let's do Lucas. Narcissistic Lucas.
What?
No, it's a guy that just a kind of metaphor, parable.
A metaphor, okay. What about him?
This guy loves the mirror. Loves the mirror.
That's a weird thing to love. It's an inanimate object.
I know. That's so. I liked the podcast with Richard Rohr. I thought his stuff on rituals for season marking seasons of life and how it's the way to learn something without the lecture method. Mm-hmm. I thought that was money.
Because that's not something we do, and I think we definitely need it.
You know, it's not something like in evangelical world that happens a lot, but I'm noticing, I was thinking about it after hearing that, like in Abilene, we do have things that kind of bubbled up, like Walk to Emmaus.
Yeah.
And in Dallas, The Quest, I think is what it's called, where guys would go off for like 5 days with other guys.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the guy in the Roots, the drummer.
No, the Quest is like I think it's basically like 5 days of almost rite of passage stuff that I'm guessing people don't get.
Do you think about this kind of stuff as you've got like 14 kids, right? And you've got at least one boy, if I'm correct.
Right? Two boys, yeah.
Yeah, two boys, at least one. As you, and I have all daughters, so it's not really in my front of my brain, but as you think about parenting your boys, do you think, how can I create these sort of rituals for them as they develop and become men?
Yeah, I have thought about that, and I've also thought about it like from a community standpoint.
Let me just interrupt myself, you first. As a father of daughters, there are plenty of rituals that I need to create for my daughters. I'm not saying girls don't need rituals. I'm just saying we are talking about male rituals in our society. Carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's an important thing of like marking life and marking different kinds of life. And Rohr was, I think, pretty spot on about we don't do that. We need to do that. And I'm seeing it come up in different areas for guys who are like, you know, in their 50s, who have never really been told like you're an adult. And it's powerful. Yeah. Like,
it seems like we don't have the emphasis or concern for blessings. And it seems like a grandfather or a father's blessing at a pivotal moment when you graduate from college or you're about to get married or those kind of, where you get the first job, for someone to lay their hands on your shoulder and say, I believe in you, you are now one of us. Just something like that would make such a difference for some of us.
When I graduated college, my roommate asked me, who are the men who have meant the most to you in your life? And I gave him, like, I thought it was just him asking for some ministry project he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I gave him like 10 names, and he asked all 10 of them to write me a letter.
How come?
And they did.
Get asked to write a letter to you.
Well, we didn't know each other then.
Oh, okay, that's it.
No, I don't know that that's it. But
when you got these letters, what did that do for you?
I still have it. I still have it in my, within 5 feet of me right now. And
would you like to read one?
Oh gosh, no, not at all. But it's like this really, it's a meaningful thing to me because it was that. It was this like, well, I believe in you and your future. And so it could be just as small as that, but I do think that there is a need that we have to not hang our identities on our not mark our life out by degrees or job changes or, you know, how our job is doing, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of things. And honestly, the modern world hasn't really created that because it hasn't seen a lot of value to it. How do you feel about how much Richard Rohr doted on you?
I don't understand why you keep going back to that. I feel like that's just two friends that are always encouraging of each other.
Yeah.
And Richard.
Yeah, I don't feel like that. I feel like
I feel like you should take notes from him and maybe treat me more like that.
I bet you do. He's not just talking to me, podcast listeners. He's talking to all of you now.
Oh, come on now.
I loved your, you know what, my biggest struggle. And by the way, I don't think you posted part two yet, so people haven't heard this part, I don't think.
Yeah, I cut it right before the Enneagram stuff.
So one of the things you're going to hear in the future, and I just want everybody to be looking out for it, is that Luke at one point said something like, yeah, my greatest struggle is just being really, like a Zoolander moment. It's just being really, really attractive.
Nope, this did not happen at all.
It did happen.
No, that is not anywhere close to what happened. No, okay, nothing. There's no way in the world I'd ever say that.
There's no spin.
He was talking about, I'm a number three, and he said.
Okay, you're a number three that tried to pretend to be a number seven because N.T. Wright is
No. Yeah. He said beforehand.
The same Enneagram.
He thought I was like N.T. Wright. Now, there's a lot of things that me and N.T. Wright have in common. And maybe he just was confused by, I don't know, intellect, wisdom.
I've been in the same room with you and N.T. Wright.
I know. And it was hard for you. You reached out to shake my hand afterwards and said, thank you, Tom. And I said, no, it's Luke. It's okay. It's easy to confuse us. But he made a comment about us, me and Tom, both being sevens. And I said, I'm not sure I've really felt at home as a three. People will listen to the show and they will understand it. Okay. The point is we're all different. Okay. And we all have our strengths. And if you remember back, speaking of when we were in Nashville with Tom, do you remember we're going to get pizza? We got out of the car. I think you got out first. And I come out of the car. Maybe I was on a phone call or something. And you were talking to two people. There was a dad and his son. They needed food. They were homeless or something. You helped them out. You got them lunch. That's your way of helping people out. We go inside the pizzeria, and the waiter comes over and asks me a question. Do you remember what he asked me about?
Your haircut.
And you know what? I told him where I got my haircut. And so both of us do different things, but we're both trying to help people.
Oh, gosh. It's your burden to bear. He did not. The waiter did not ask me any appearance-related advice.
So that's the beauty of all of us having a place in the kingdom of heaven. We all can help one another in different ways.
So what did you say to him? Because it was something like, you know, I feel bad for saying this, but in high school, some people told me often
stop. We're done. We're not talking about this anymore.
What did you say?
No, we're not talking about that.
It felt like I was listening to like a therapy session with the Kardashians for just a second.
No, it was not that at all. Okay. He said something about, you know, number threes. In his book, he says, you know, number threes often are like good-looking people or something. And he goes on from there and connected that to me, and he talked about how that impacts things. And I was trying to communicate how I was affirming him. You know, in the world of improv, when someone says something, you say yes and.
Yeah.
In the world of a good interviewer, I was just saying yes and to whatever he said. I'm just trying to do my job. I don't think whatever you're saying is nice or honest or even Christian, for that matter.
Luke, you're so attractive. Yes and. What else? Yes and.
Okay.
To be fair, I actually thought the point that he was making was actually really helpful, which is, remember David Foster Wallace, not the point, but remember David Foster Wallace's thing about worship your beauty and you'll always feel ugly, worship your intelligence and you'll always feel dumb, that part of the challenge that people have who excel in one certain aspect of life is there will come a time when people who are very attractive are no longer attractive. And if you build your self-esteem or your identity, self-worth around those things, it collapses.
Yeah.
And I thought Richard Rohr was trying to be a good spiritual director to lots of people. That's why he kept encouraging you to leave it in, even though, to your credit, I know it's kind of got to be embarrassing. Especially just because of the disconnect between reality and what was said.
Oh, this is terrible. All right, we're going to be done now.
Okay.
Jonathan, it's been fun. Thanks as always. Hey, let me give you a heads up. Next month, We've got a good month packed for you. We're going to have the second part of the Roar interview. We've got Josh Graves, our mutual friend, his book. I think it's titled How Not to Kill a Muslim. Does that sound right? We'll talk about that. Rachel Held Evans, Lauren Winner, they both got books that we're going to talk to them about. And so we'll probably have some more in there at the end as well. But look forward to that. And Jonathan?
Is next month sponsored by like your favorite mirror brand?
No, it's sponsored by your favorite store like Piggly Wiggly.
Don't you denigrate Piggly Wiggly.
First of all, I'm very... When did you learn the word denigrate? I don't know how you figured that one out, but I'm glad you did. Jonathan, I don't appreciate you always mocking me, and I don't appreciate the mean things you say to me, but I do appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
All right, friends, let me remind you one more time, Praxis Conference, May 15th and 16th, Houston, Texas. Go to praxisconference.com for more information. And don't forget, when you go there to register, type in the code Praxis_Norsworthy to get your 25% off. I hope you guys go sign up. I hope you enjoy your trip down to Houston, and I hope to see you there May 15th and 16th. For more information, praxisconference.com.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. We'll see you back here next time.